loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big issues. First, Chief of Staff General John Kelly, frequently praised by liberals for being the adult in the room of Trump's White House, gave an interview yesterday to Laura Ingraham where he said that the U.S. Civil War happened because of a failure to compromise, causing outrage across the country. What's the real history here? Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Race to Revolution, The U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, joins us for this important segment. Then, tech giants Facebook, Google, and Twitter are testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee this afternoon as the media works itself up into another frenzy over the so-called Russian ads influencing the 2016 election. Kevin Zeese, the co-director of PopularResistance.org, and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek are our guests for that discussion. Stay with us for Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the comments of General John Kelly about the U.S. Civil War. Donald Trump's Chief of Staff, General John Kelly, frequently praised by liberals for being the, quote, adult in the room, close quote, of Donald Trump's White House, gave an interview yesterday to Laura Ingraham where he said the U.S. Civil War happened because of a failure to compromise, causing outrage across the country. What's the real history and what does this say about General Kelly? We are joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Welcome back, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
So John Kelly said, I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War, and men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had to make their stand. Go ahead.
Well, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee quite famously referred to the White House as an adult daycare center, with presumably John Kelly being one of the minders, but apparently you have more than one infant in that adult daycare center, referring to a mental infant. What I'm suggesting is that what General Kelly has done in his attempt to build a bridge to the neo-Confederates who marched on Charlottesville in August 2017, shouting and chanting, "Jews will not replace us," in an attempt to build a bridge to those retrograde elements, he basically spit in the eye, not only of U.S. patriots, taking that term quite literally, because, of course, the Confederates sought to murder and did murder U.S. patriots as they sought to overthrow the United States government by force of arms, but he also obviously insulted the descendants of enslaved Africans because, as any school child should be able to tell you, the North and the South had been compromising for decades in the run-up to the proclamation of the U.S. Civil War in 1861, most famously or infamously in the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which allowed Missouri to enter the Union as a slave state, and then Maine was broken off from Massachusetts and was entered as a so-called free state. And there have been many other compromises before then. But General Kelly obviously does not recognize that there was an irreconcilable antagonism between the enslaved and their so-called owners. That is to say, the so-called owners, the slaveholders, were saying that they deserved the right to own human beings, and the human beings in question said, hell no. And it's difficult to find a bridge that will allow one to compromise on that basis. Doing so does violence to history, insults, once again, true U.S. patriots, not to mention the descendants of enslaved Africans, and exposes and reveals Mr. Kelly, for the intellectual and political midget that he actually is.
Dr. Horn, I live in Virginia, but I'm not from Virginia. I'm from Pennsylvania. And it wasn't until I moved to Virginia as an adult that I finally realized that not everybody is taught in school that Robert E. Lee was a traitor. I came to Virginia and I see schools named after Robert E. Lee and Lee Highway and any number of public buildings, all named after Robert E. Lee. I posted this article on my Facebook page today, and I said that I always believed that Robert E. Lee was a traitor. And I was surprised at how many people jumped on me and said things like, historical relativism much? So help me and help our listeners. I'm not a historian. I just kind of have a gut response to this story and this issue. Help me to explain why this is not historical relativism, that treason is defined in the Constitution of the United States. And when someone takes up arms against his country, he is a traitor.
General Robert E. Lee not only took up arms against the government he was sworn to defend, but as I pointed out actually in my book on the Haitian Revolution, the Confederates also were busily negotiating with the French, who had taken over Mexico during the early 1860s, in order to make an alliance with the French in Mexico against the government of the United States. So they actually not only took up arms against the government of the United States, but they also were trying to forge an alliance with a foreign power in order to overthrow the government of the United States of America. I think that ultimately you cannot understand this apparent conundrum that leaped out from you on your Facebook page. You cannot understand that unless you understand some of the history of the United States and understand that after the Confederates were finally defeated in 1865, there was a desperate attempt to have what was called sectional reconciliation, that is to say between North and South, but actually it was an intraracial reconciliation, that is to say between the so-called whites who raised arms against the United States government and the so-called whites who defended the United States government. And you can't understand the desperate need for that reconciliation unless you understand the true origins of not only the United States of America, which I talk about in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, but also understand the origins of European settlement after the European invasion of North America in the 1600s. And excuse me, the point of personal privilege, I have a book on January coming out on that subject.
Excellent.
That is to say that the European invaders were faced with a united front of indigenous peoples, oftentimes assisted by enslaved Africans, oftentimes backed by a foreign power, for example, Spain in the 1600s. And there was a desperate need to have settler unity and to have, to put it another way, white unity, white nationalism, in other words, which, of course, is raising its ugly head again in 2017. And as a result of this idea that there had to be a solid settler unity, a solid white unity in order to conquer a continent and enslave Africans and subdue Native Americans, that principle is the underlying true principle of U.S. history that was not adequately dealt with after the slaveholders were defeated in 1865, and quite frankly, has not been dealt with adequately to this very day in 2017, which is why you have these ignorant comments by General Kelly once again trying to reconcile the white settlers on one side of the fence and the white settlers on the other side of the fence, rather than dealing with humanity and with the fact that the enslaved Africans and their descendants deserve a modicum of respect as well.
We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. He is a historian, a prolific author. We're talking about General John Kelly's statement yesterday that the U.S. Civil War happened because of a failure to compromise, where he was also praising Robert E. Lee as an honorable man. Of course, echoing Donald Trump's recent comments about very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville. I was looking around with, because a lot of people are covering this today. In the Atlantic magazine, there was some reportage of how Robert E. Lee actually functioned as a slave owner. Not very, quote, honorable at all. Of course, the enslavement of people is not honorable. There's nothing that can be ever construed to be honorable. But he was also a torturer. Here's one account. When two of his slaves escaped and were recaptured, Lee either beat them himself or ordered the overseer to lay it on well, close quote. Wesley Norris, one of the slaves who was whipped, recalled that not satisfied with simply lacerating our naked flesh, General Lee then ordered the overseer to thoroughly wash our backs with brine, that's salt, which was done, close quote. I mean, this guy tortured African people who attempted to escape. His brutality as a slave owner was such that it, here's another one by historian Pryor. Lee's heavy hand on the Arlington plantation nearly led to a slave revolt, in part because the enslaved had been expected to be freed upon their previous master's death, and Lee had engaged in a dubious legal interpretation of his will in order to keep them as his property, one that lasted until a Virginia court forced him to free them. When the battle at Gettysburg happened, General Horn, some of these same accounts talk about how Lee's Southern Army actually captured free black people in Pennsylvania and took them back to the South as they retreated as newly enslaved people. Not an honorable man.
You know, I think most Americans also, if I can interject one thought here before you respond, Professor, I think that most Americans don't know that a young Major Robert E. Lee was responsible for the capture and the eventual hanging of John Brown.
And John Brown, of course, for those who might have missed that class in history, was the Euro-American man who in 1859 sought to lead an armed uprising against slavery in the United States. And as you suggested, was captured by Robert E. Lee and then hung in December 1859. He's probably the white man most celebrated and most honored in black history. There is a street in Haiti, the first free republic, named after John Brown. W.E.B. Du Bois, a founder of the NAACP and the father of Pan-Africanism, wrote a biography of John Brown, and he continues to be celebrated. But I think that what this reminds me of, this entire episode, is rank hypocrisy. I recall when the former Yugoslavia was breaking up, and the advice from this side of the Atlantic was face your history, no matter how painful. Because if you don't face your history, it will come back to bite you. We're marking the centennial of the Russian Revolution. And of course, in the U.S. press, the U.S. organs are castigating the history of Russia on all levels and saying that Moscow has not sufficiently faced its history. But I think that we should say, physician, heal thyself. That is to say, the United States should face its own history. It should face the fact that it was started in a rebellion against the abolition of slavery in London. That's what led the slave owners, led by slaveholder number one, George Washington, to lead an armed rebellion against London. Not only that, but London and the Royal Proclamation of 1763 had sought to restrain the real estate speculators like George Washington from moving west and seizing the land of the Native Americans and causing London to expend blood and treasure to fight the Native Americans so George Washington can profit. And so they wanted to continue that dual project of taking the land of Native Americans and increasing the number of enslaved Africans rather than abolishing slavery. And that's what's led us today not only to the ignoramus known otherwise as John Kelly, but also to the reason that Black Lives Matter had to organize, because officers of the state continue to slay and murder black citizens without due process of law at all. And this is directly related not only to the fact that black citizens continue to carry the mark of slavery and are a reminder of the grimy origins of this country, but also because black citizens refuse to accept benignly the idea that they would be exploited in order to build this republic. And so they fought hammer and tongue against this republic from the end of the 18th century up until this very day. And as a result, in 2017, continued to be punished by being slain by the police without due process of law and being insulted by the chief of staff of the White House, who obviously missed classes in history, probably on John Brown too, that he should have been enrolled in.
We're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn from Texas. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day at 105.5 FM between 4 and 6 p.m. We're talking about General John Kelly's statement that the Civil War was basically a mistake. It could have been avoided with just another compromise. The other thing that comes through in Kelly's comments, and that this is true for all of the apologists like Kelly, is that somehow the Civil War wasn't really about slavery. It wasn't about the enslavement of African people. When the South seceded, the first state to secede was South Carolina. The official statement of the secessionists was this, and I want to read this paragraph for people, because this says why they seceded. This is why the war started. A geographical line has been drawn across the Union, and all the states north of that line have united in the election of a man to the high office of the President of the United States whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery. He is to be entrusted with the administration of the common government because he has declared that, quote, government cannot endure permanently half slave, half free, close quote, and that the public mind must rest in the belief that slavery is in the course of ultimate extinction. This sectional combination for the submersion of the Constitution has been aided in some of the states by elevating to citizenship persons who, by the supreme law of the land, are incapable of becoming citizens, and their votes have been used to inaugurate a new policy hostile to the South and destructive of its beliefs in safety. I mean, that's the these are the people who started the Civil War. It's all about and completely about not states' rights. It's about enslavement. Go ahead, Dr. Horn.
Well, it's not only that, but your listeners may also want to look up the name of Alexander Stevens with a P, not a V, the vice president of the so-called Confederate States of America, who was even more explicit and bloodthirsty in terms of explaining why slavery was at the root of the U.S. Civil War. Keep in mind that on the verge of the U.S. Civil War, property in enslaved Africans was the most valuable property in these United States of America. The 4 million enslaved Africans were worth billions. That's one of the reasons why the United States went to war with London and the War of 1812, because many of that property were escaping northward to Canada, which was then part of the British Empire. And the United States wanted to cut off that escape route by seizing Canada and fortunately failed. People in this country need to come to grips with the bitter reality that the United States exists, not least because it is the product of one of the most massive robberies in world history. I'm speaking in the first instance about the theft of Native American land. I was looking at the book by the scholar David Wilkins, Hollow Justice, A History of Indigenous Claims in the United States, where he amends Woody Guthrie's famous song, "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land," by saying, actually, no, this land was our land, speaking of Native Americans, and there should be a yellow police stripe across the borders of the United States from the Atlantic to the Pacific and all along the Canadian border and perhaps even north of the Canadian border, suggesting that this has been one of the most massive robberies in human history. Second of all, it has been the site of the massive robbery of the free labor of enslaved Africans. And that is one of the reasons why the United States finds itself in such a dilemma today. That is to say, it has failed to come to grips with its history. It's tried to soothe itself with fairy tales instead of history. And that has allowed a carnival barker and a con man to enter the highest office in the land, into the Oval Office, and is rapidly leading this country to the brink of destruction assisted, I might say, by General Kelly, who some had touted falsely as being one of the adults in the room, when actually, once again, he's just another person who needs to be minded in that adult daycare center known as the White House.
You know, Brian, it seems like President Trump and General Kelly are in dire need of a sixth grade history lesson, first of all. Secondly, it makes me wonder about the state of public education in this country, where, you know, you've got a state like Texas, for example, that just published a new statewide textbook that doesn't even mention the Civil War, as if it didn't happen, let alone failed to educate our children as to the reasons why we had a Civil War in the first place. And that's not just Texas. We find that kind of situation all over the South. It's no wonder that Mississippi is 50th out of 50 states in education and Alabama is 49th, because that's the kind of quality that children, quality education that children are getting in those states. But there's a price to pay for this kind of thing. You end up producing idiots who are ill-equipped to enter real life. And then we have people like General Kelly, who are supposed to be the adults in the room, an utterly dysfunctional White House, and in fact, who are incapable of being the adults in the room.
And reflecting all the biases, the real, I would say, real values and beliefs of so many, the South lost the Civil War, but in some ways, by the turn of the century, certainly, by the 1890s, had won the battle of public relations. And that's when all these Confederate monuments from 1890s to 1920s, each time there's some surge for Black freedom, there's this backlash and then this love of the Confederacy and then this myth that it's not about slavery and enslavement, sort of as the fairy tale, as Dr. Horn is talking about. I was just looking at the statement from Mississippi right after South Carolina seceded. Mississippi's statement started, this was in 1861 at this secession, "Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. Its labor supplies the product which constitutes by far the largest and most important portions of commerce on the earth." This embrace, real commercial and value embrace of slavery, is what caused the Civil War. Dr. Horn, we have about 6-7 minutes left. Help our audience keep going with this. This is an important subject. And I think the American history books not only get the Civil War wrong, they get all wars wrong. I just saw a statistic where the majority of young people think the Vietnam War was not a mistake. That could only be achieved through the way public education teaches the Vietnam War.
Well, and public miseducation and maleducation is not some kind of blunder. It is part of a design, and all you have to do is look at the philosophy of the present Secretary of Education, Betty DeVos, who is busily and eagerly trying to wreck public education. You know that the titans of Wall Street are trying to privatize a good deal of the public education sector for the purpose of profit, more so than the question of educating alert citizens, because alert citizens is precisely what they do not want and do not need, particularly in a 21st century of the growth of artificial intelligence and robotization, where great swaths of the working class, if they have their way, will find themselves redundant and useless. But with regard to Texas, which is a special case, and it's no accident that Texas, in many ways, is at the forefront of the reactionary wave, because Texas was not only a firm supporter of the so-called Confederate States of America when it seceded in 1861 from the United States of America, but Texas had its own dress rehearsal for secession in 1836, when, under the leadership of Stephen F. Austin and Sam Houston, Texas seceded from Mexico, not least because in the previous decade, in the 1820s, Mexico had moved to abolish slavery, and Mexico had a president of African origin, Vicente Guerrero, in the 1820s, 180 years before the election of one Barack Obama. And rather than accede to such leadership, Texas had its own secession and created the so-called Lone Star Republic, which became a leading slave trading nation The Lone Star flag is responsible for a good deal of the Africans who are now on the island of Cuba, for example, from their port in Galveston, Texas. You had the Lone Star flag engaged in slave trading off the coast of Brazil and off the coast of Angola, dragging Africans from one shore to another. And you are correct with regard to this counter-reaction, which is a major theme of U.S. history. One might even say counter-revolution has been the central theme of U.S. history. Recall that the present era of counter-revolution we're in some ways, was kicked off in August 1980, when then GOP presidential candidate Ronald Wilson Reagan opened his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which happened to be the site of a famous or infamous slaying of civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964, memorialized falsely, I might add, in the film Mississippi Burning, which portrays the FBI as heroes when actually they were antagonists. But that was a signal to Dixie that the era of advance for Black people had come to a screeching halt. And we have been in that era of counter-revolution since 1980, which then reached a crescendo in November 2016, with the election of the certified misogynist and sexual predator and carnival barker and con man, otherwise known as Donald J. Trump.
Why is it that, well, it seems to me that people like General Kelly, who just ignore history, and to tell you the truth, I think General Kelly and President Trump and those around him just hate African-American people. I think it comes down to a simple issue of racism, and I'm sure I'll take heat for that, but I don't care. That's just how I feel. Why is it, how is it that they and so many Americans like them have been successful in turning the public debate, turning public opinion away from the issues that matter, issues of equality and human rights and civil liberties and civil rights, to an issue of historical relativism, as I said earlier, or these ridiculous Confederate monuments and memorials? It seems like we have truth on our side, we have history on our side, and somehow we have not been successful in explaining that side to the American people, and the racists have.
And Gerald Horton, let me just jump in real quick. Let's go back, and I want you to, we have about 3.5 minutes left or 4 minutes to explain, because the capture of John Brown, 1859 in Harper's Ferry, it was Robert E. Lee, as we've talked about, who led that capture. He led the military excursion. At that time, he was representing the United States government. He was the military leader representing the United States government. And then Lincoln is elected, and then the state, Virginia, and the other states in the South secede for no other reason than they felt that Lincoln's election portended the ultimate, eventual, gradual, even if Lincoln didn't say so, end of the system of slavery. I mean, he was 100% committed to slavery. He was very happy to kill John Brown. I mean, the court found him guilty and that he was hung. But anyway, go ahead. We have 2 minutes left, Dr. Horn.
Well, first of all, I think we need to realize that the 63 million folks who voted for Donald J. Trump, there are a number of ways to look at that 63 million. Irrespective of their class background, and let's not enter the debate as to what percentage was of the working class and what percentage was of the middle class, given the fact that in 1991, 55% of the Euro-American population in Louisiana voted for David Duke, a neo-Nazi, for governor, we should not necessarily be surprised by that 63 million voting for Trump in 2016. We can either say that they're victims of false consciousness, or we can say that they're responding to the signals that Donald J. Trump and John Kelly are sending with regard to praising Confederate heroes, so-called, and with regard to saying that there were good and fine people who were marching in an anti-Semitic racist march in Charlottesville. In other words, they feel, given those signals, that the clock can be turned back. And those of us who've studied history know that the clock can turn back. It's a falsehood to suggest that history moves progressively forward. Otherwise, you would not have had the abolition of certain French-controlled Caribbean islands in the early 1800s, and then the return of slavery with the counter-reaction against the Haitian Revolution during that same time. And history turning back in the United States would mean that those defined as white would have enhanced privileges against those not so endowed. We know that in the beginning of the 19th century, Europeans fresh off the boat were able to claim land of Native Americans who were being chased off the land. For example, in Georgia, where the Cherokees were chased westward into Oklahoma. So this is the dilemma that we're confronted with, and John Kelly is not helping things with his ignorant remarks.
Very well stated. The clock can be turned back. We have to fight to make sure that that doesn't happen, but that requires a fight. We've been joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history at the University of Houston, prolific author. One of his books, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. More books to follow. Thank you, Professor Horn. After a short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The tech giants, Facebook, Google, and Twitter, they're all here in Washington, D.C., testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee this afternoon as the media works itself up into another frenzy over the so-called Russian ads influencing the 2016 election. We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeis. He is the co-director of Popular Resistance. You can read his writings at popularresistance.org. And in studio by Walter Smolarek, he is a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome, Kevin and Walter.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to be here.
Kevin Zeis, you know, when you look back at the last few months, it seemed at the beginning Facebook and Twitter were minimizing, saying this is kind of like not really a thing, that there wasn't really any influence by Russia vis-a-vis Twitter or Facebook. Then they were sort of attacked for not being, you know, doing their patriotic duty to expose Russia for its evil deeds. And then they came up and said, well, yeah, actually, they did. Russia or Russians or Russian operatives, it's never clear who these Russians are, bought as many as $100,000, say, in Facebook ads. And that, you know, is going to have this gigantic influence on the 2016 election. And now that wasn't enough. So now they're making up other numbers about how even the small number of ads or artificial accounts could have really reached hundreds of millions of people. I mean, all of this story is evolving as these tech giants are coming under greater and greater attack, it seems to me. Is that your view of it?
Well, I think that's a description of what's happened, for sure. I mean, today they're saying that they've, Facebook is saying it had 23,000 posts for 1,000th of a percent of all their posts. And what does it mean when you reach 126 million people on a Facebook ad? I know we've done Facebook ads, and reaching something doesn't mean very much. It means it's in their Facebook feed, not on their Facebook page. You know, just as I see things have been posted in their Facebook feed, big deal. We don't know what the impact of that is. I don't think the Facebook, the Twitter ads are really going to be anything that sways the outcome of the election. So I think they're barking up a tree there. That sounds big, but it's really small. The only real thing that they are being alleged to have done, that the Russians have done, that could have swayed the election was releasing the Clinton emails. But the proof of that is just not there. And I think that's what Mueller's investigation, you know, raised the issue of yesterday. But the evidence is very thin on that as well.
Yeah. When we look, Walter, at the testimony or some of the responses prepared for Congress by Elliot Schrage, he's the vice president of policy and communications at Facebook. He says these things. Here are some facts about the ads. An estimated 10 million people in the United States saw the ads. We were able to approximate the number of unique people reach who saw at least one of these ads with our best modeling. 44% of total ad impressions, that is the number of time ads were displayed, were, before the U.S. election on November 8th, 2016, 56% were after the election. So let me understand. So the Russians are taking out Facebook ads to the tune of $100,000, and 56% of them are seen by this huge number of Americans after November 8th, after the election, the majority of them. So how is that not the number one story right here, that this, I don't know, why is that not the number one story?
Yeah, it's so absolutely outrageous. So 56%, the majority of Facebook ads were seen after the election. I mean, unless there's time travel, then there's no way that that could have possibly had any type of political effect. And also just like the basic common sense test here, I think is very important. I mean, I don't know if most people in the United States have Facebook, but certainly a great, great number of our listeners will have Facebook accounts. Just think about all the Facebook ads that you saw today. Think about all the Facebook posts that you saw today. I mean, did any have like a great impact on your life or how you view the world or how you view politics? I think this memo from Elliot Strange, it was put out October 2nd, so sort of before, like you were talking about, they switched their orientation. So now instead of trying to say like, oh, well, you know, we weren't really that responsible for it, that was seen or that was perceived by the politicians who are sort of leading the witch hunt as being, you're trying to get out of it, right? You're not going along with the narrative. And so they switched their orientation and now they're fully going on with it, along with the narrative. They're in fact inflaming it by coming out with these huge numbers, much larger than the numbers that they had originally put out. And they're saying, see, we're good participants in this now, so we'll testify before your Senate committees, we'll testify before the House if we have to, we'll do whatever we need to do so that this narrative moves on to the next target. And so the next group of people or industry or companies or organizations, they can be the Russian spies next.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, now they're saying on Facebook as many as 126 million people may have seen content from accounts tied to Russian sources. So they may have seen it or they may not have seen it. They may be tied to Russian sources, but are those Russian sources like companies in Russia that buy Facebook ads? We now know that, you know, Twitter, by the way, Kevin, I'm sure you saw the news, Twitter has banned Sputnik, for instance, from buying any more ads on Twitter. The funny thing there is Sputnik never bought an ad on Twitter. But, you know, now it'll never happen again. Oh, wait, it never happened. So,
yeah, I really have doubt. What does that Russia linked stuff mean? You know, when they describe Russia linked, what does that even mean? You know, why aren't they more explicit about who these purchasers were? Like you say, they could be Russia corporations. They could be Russian nonprofits. They could be, there's so many Russians that could, it's a rather large country. Not everyone's linked to the government. How many of those ads actually dealt with the election?
Yeah, like, can you imagine if some other country said, linked to America, ads on Facebook linked to America? So Chrysler takes an ad. That's America. That's the American government. I mean, there's just this one monolith. It's like the old anti-communist witch hunt where...
It is.
You know, and I've said this before on the show, when I was handing out leaflets as a 15-year-old against the war in Vietnam, people would drive by and yell out their car window, go back to Russia. And I always wondered, like, what? Russia? I've never been to Russia. What does that have to do with this? I didn't get it. I didn't know enough. I didn't know enough to understand the witch hunt at the time.
Well, you know, just along this topic, another thing, the company that's alleged to have taken out these ads, it's called the Internet Research Agency. And so the news articles very rarely explain that the Internet Research Agency is not like an official agency of the Russian government, because the name kind of like makes it sound official, right? I mean, one would think if you just see that in print, oh, this is the Russian Internet Research Agency, but it's not. It's just the name of a company, right? It's official sounding, but it has nothing to do, you know, formally with the Russian government.
Yeah, and let's go back again. Elliot Schrage, Vice President of Policy and Communications for Facebook, he wrote this on this update on October 6th. This is before Facebook and Twitter and Google were hit for not being patriotic enough, not generally embracing the narrative that Russia was responsible for all things. Back then, he wrote, listen to this statistic. This is about the $100,000 in ads, which today they're saying may have reached 126 million people. But back on October 6th, He writes, this is an official intervention by Facebook, by the person who is the vice president of policy and communications. He writes, roughly 25% of the ads were never shown to anyone. That's because advertising auctions are designed so that ads reach people based on relevance, and certain ads may not reach anyone as a result. So 25% of these ads, Kevin, were never seen by anyone, but they undoubtedly had a major impact on their thinking. That's what we're asked to believe.
Such a bizarre thing. So do we have any idea what kind of threats or pressure was put on Facebook from the beginning of the month to the end of the month now to get them to change their stories so drastically? Because it's a really dramatic change in the amount of ads, how people saw them, what the impact was. All this stuff is like reversed now in the last month. What kind of pressure? I'm curious, they have these congressional committees or other government sources put on to get them to change their story. Because this obviously is not done because there's some new information. This changes. They had done the research back in early October. They've changed the research. Why?
Yeah, indeed. And it reminds me, again, going back to the witch hunts, during the witch hunt period, the ACLU, which was the champion of civil liberties and civil rights during the late 1940s and 1950s, they switched over and started naming names to the House of Un-American Activities Committee. They started telling the government, oh, this person, yeah, that person, that, meaning somebody signed a petition for a peace and the peace organization was somehow linked to a front group linked to the Communist Party. So you signed a petition. So they started naming names. And the reason they named names was because then the ACLU can say, we're not like them. We're not like the targeted entity. We're not the communists. I mean, that's how these witch hunts go forward. Again, another statistic, before this hysteria was directed partly against Facebook and Twitter and Google for not embracing the witch hunt more fervently, Walter, again, Elliot Schrades back on October 6th, vice president of policy and communication for Facebook, he writes, we just covered 25% of the ads nobody saw, right? Nobody. 50% of the ads were less than $3. In terms of the amount spent, less than $3. The Russians have us right by the throat, Walter.
Yeah, like why would a state? I mean, so there are two sides to this. I mean, one, we have to, of course, dispel the notion in the Russia witch hunt that like Russia is this all-powerful entity that controls all things that we see on the internet, and their troll farms are just so expansive, and they control YouTube and blah, 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 blah. That's all totally silly. But also, like, Russia is a state, right? It's like it's a not insignificant state. It has, serious resources at its disposal. Like, why would they spend $3 on anything? I mean, why not? I mean, like, scale up and get the better deals like the Facebook advertising salespeople will tell you to do. It's just so silly. The other thing, going back to that memo, I saw that it claims that $6,700 was spent on Instagram ads. Like, why even bother if you're only going to spend $6,700 on something? Like, if your goal is to flip the election of the most powerful empire that's ever existed in human history, like, you're going to have to spend more than $6,700 on some of these things.
So, okay, again, for our audience, because it's hard to remember the facts when we're being deluged with new facts, 56% of the ads for Facebook, apparently by Russians of some sort, where after the election, 25% of those ads were never seen by anyone. 50% cost less than $3 each. 99%, according to Facebook, cost less than $1,000. In other words, really minuscule efforts. In other words, the Russian government is a pretty feeble operation, it would seem to me, if these statistics before Facebook capitulated to the witch hunt are to be believed. But, Kevin, when we talk about money and we talk about influence, there's different elements here because, the government, or I mean, the people running for office and the media that profited from them getting ads, a lot of money was spent to influence the American people. And a lot of media, free media time was given, especially to Donald Trump. I mean, and then we had Hillary Clinton hiring, apparently in the DNC, a foreign intelligence agency that would be, or agent, former agent from Britain, Christopher Steele, to dig up dirty laundry on Donald Trump. In other words, he's from Britain. Anyway, talk about the actual way that media impacts people's consciousness and the way money impacts the elections in America.
Well, that's what I was thinking about when you were saying $3 ad and other ads up to $1,000. You know, $1,000, that sounds like a bit for me. That's an expensive ad, right? If I was, you know, a little nonprofit. But you're talking about U.S. elections, presidential elections. Where the advertising budgets are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Hundreds of millions of dollars. So these little ads that are, and they're fleeting ads. These are like ads that just go by your computer screen. If you happen to be one of the small percentage who sees it, they're little ads that go by your computer screen and disappear. They're paragraph long ads in an election that's hundreds of millions of dollars. That's why I said at the beginning, this whole Facebook, Twitter thing. Let me just say this: the Facebook Twitter thing is really nothing when you can look at it. If we did a bar graph of election advertising, and we had the Trump campaign, we had the Clinton campaign, and we had the so-called Russian-related people or organizations, whatever that, I'm not even sure they are, the Russian ads. And on the bar graph, you wouldn't even see the Russian ads. In comparison, it's just so minute, so tiny, so unimportant. And then that doesn't influence the outcome of the election. Even if it were true, even if every one of those ads was Russian government doing it would be illegal. So that would be, I'd be surprised if any of them were Russian government. But even if there was a front groups for Russia doing it to hide it with the Russian government, all the ads would add up to zero. Absolutely no impact at all. And then the other thing they point to in this Russiagate theory is RT and other media outlets. But if I look at the reporting done on these so-called Russian media outlets, what I see is reporting. One thing they do differently on RT is they sometimes let third party candidates participate. Is that what switched the outcome of the election? I mean, see, look at their news reporting, the news reporting of these Russian outlets. I don't see anything that actually has a big difference, a big impact. So it's a really strange thing that the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign are pursuing this Russiagate perspective, because it doesn't seem to hold much water, and the failures of it are pretty evident.
I'm looking, Walter, at a website called Ad Age. It talks about advertising, and I want to go to what Kevin is talking about in the bar that he's working on, the graph. Here's the headline: Data-driven targeting creates huge 2016 political ad shift. Broadcast TV down 20%, cable and digital way up. First paragraph, the 2016 election outcome was unpredictable, not only because Donald Trump's presidential victory, but in terms of where the money went. According to a new report from media tracker Borrell Associates, the final tally of political campaign ad spending in the 2016 election cycle came in lower than anticipated. It's lower. It was only $9.8 billion.
Oh, my God.
And while broadcast TV retained its dominance, the mass media mainstay of political advertising took a big blow from more targetable and data-driven ad options such as cable TV and digital. According to Borrell, broadcast TV spending fell nearly 20% this cycle compared with 2012. This isn't just the presidential. This includes senators and congresspeople. But still, the president is the flagship of all spending, the presidential contest. It was way down from 2012. From $5.4 billion in 2012, it went to $4.4 billion in 2016. Radio was way down by 23%, but digital advertising, which includes video ads, mobile, email, social, and search, broke the billion-dollar mark, reaching $1.4 billion and growing a staggering 789% since 2012. $1.4 billion. A billion is 1,000 millions, in case people don't have their calculator with them. So That's 1,400 millions of dollars spent on targeted digital advertising, Walter. We're talking about $100,000 in Facebook ads, 56% of which were seen after the election, 25% of which were not seen by anybody, 95% of which were under $3. Amazing when you actually look at the facts.
Yeah, I mean, there are hostile outside powers menacing democracy. That is true, and those hostile outside powers are rich people and corporations. There are, you know, billions, all the numbers that you just said, like, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars. You know, it's like a prohibitively, obviously, very prohibitively high bar if you want to run for a public office. If, you know, even to run for like a local position, you might have to raise like $1 million so you can buy all of these ads, be it on social media or on regular broadcast or print media outlets. You know, and you need to get that money from rich people or corporations or, you know, the political entities that they donate to. I mean, that's the threat to democracy. And, you know, the real way that the media, the narrative about the situation in the United States is manipulated, it's not because outside powers stir up divisions, you know, like the racist line in the mass media has been saying about Black Lives Matter. It's because the mainstream media, the corporate owned media that dominates the airwaves and the television and, you know, to an increasing extent, the internet, they're able to set the terms of the debate and to agree upon, you know, the ground rules, like the United States should be the most dominant country in the world. You know, rich people are rich because they work hard. You know, these fundamental assumptions that are the real sources of propaganda, that is coming straight from these, you know, massive corporations.
And Kevin Zeese, the other thing is, in addition to the paid ads paid by corporations, there's all the free media time that Leslie Moombs, the CEO of CBS, that famous quote from him when they were giving all of this free coverage to Donald Trump because he was increasing ratings because everybody thought it was entertainment, like, you know, reality TV, for instance. He said, oh, this is probably bad for the country, but it's good for CBS. For Zucker, the CEO of CNN, New York Times did a whole New York Times Sunday Magazine section way back when. He said CNN had a problem. Donald Trump solved it because everybody tuned in to watch all the free coverage of Donald Trump. That was before CNN, you know, sort of decisively turned against Trump after he won the nomination for the Republican nomination, when he was just considered to be, you know, a rating driving recreational figure. They made Donald Trump a thing. It wasn't Sputnik. Matter of fact, anybody listening to our shows during that time, we were all very, very, very much against Donald Trump. We weren't for Hillary Clinton, but we were opposed to Trump. That's what made Donald Trump a thing.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, this whole, when you look at the facts, and in the last 5 minutes, we really kind of drawn the absurd bar graph that shows Russia versus advertising by the campaigns. It's just, this whole discussion is absurdity, that we even consider that Russia impacted the outcome of the election through advertising or through their media outlets, which are legitimate outlets in the United States. It's just such a fanciful thing. But then you contrast that to like what's happening right now with the United States in regard to Venezuela. Venezuela just had a recent election. No one questions the authenticity of this election. There are outside observers. They do recounts regularly. It's one of the best electoral systems in the world. The oligarchs that are supporting the United States lost more than 90% of the governorships. What's Trump's reaction? Threatening military action against Venezuela because of this election outcome. Now that's affecting the outcome of elections. When you know, the biggest military in the world threatens military action because they picked the people, the candidates who didn't represent the oligarch U.S. interests. That's a real contrast.
Yeah, so true. And here we have also the U.S., like they spent $5 billion in Ukraine ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, $5 billion for democracy. Well, what does that mean? That means to try to influence what happens in Ukraine.
And Brian, let me just say something about the Ukraine thing. That's not just to influence elections. The U.S. has been spending money in Ukraine since since before 2000, but aggressively since 2000. And it wasn't until after an election. It was a non-election. It was a coup. It was a regime change effort outside a year before the election to get the Russian out and get the pro-U.S. candidate in. That's what that's what the U.S. money supported. So influencing, it's not only influencing elections that the U.S. does, which is bad enough. It's creating regime change when there are legitimate elections and ignoring those.
And the thesis on Ukraine was quite interesting. Yanukovych may have had a relationship with Paul Manafort, who had a relationship with Tony Podesta, the Democrat, to promote Yanukovych's influence in Washington. Russia probably viewed that influence gathering effort to be very bad for Russia because Yanukovych was kind of playing both sides off the middle. He was partly pro-EU. He was partly pro-Russia. He didn't want to be pro-only EU and not only Russia. So the coup happened in February 2014 after, as Victoria Nuland, the Secretary of State, said, the U.S. had spent $5 billion since 1991. In other words, cultivating all these NGOs who were promoting, quote, democracy in Ukraine. We saw that in Yugoslavia. We saw that in Guatemala in 1954 when the U.S. didn't like the people who the people elected Guzman. They just toppled it. Iran, a democratically elected government, Mossack Day, toppled by the CIA when the people voted the wrong way.
That's right.
Honduras. In 2009.
Oh, there's a long list. We could fill all the time up in the air here just by listing countries where the U.S. has, you know, put in place regime change operations and gotten the U.S. favored government in power and taken the U.S. opposing government out of power. That's just the American way.
And the other thing that really strikes me, if we all sort of put our thinking cap on and think back to what it was like before November 8th, I don't think we expected, I know I didn't expect, Donald Trump to have a chance of winning. I don't think anybody really thought that, or not many people. And certainly the Russians, who, according to this story, have bought, you know, $100,000 worth of ads, for only 44% of which happened before November 8th, they could not actually have thought that this kind of effort, if there was an effort, would have an influence on the outcome. That was not true. And Donald Trump actually lost the election, Walter. He lost the election by 3 million votes. It's because of the U.S. Electoral College that nobody in the summits of the establishment are talking about. That's why Donald Trump is president.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes. One would think that in a country that calls itself a democracy, in fact, the best democracy, that the candidate who got the most votes would win, right? That's kind of a fundamental logical thing, but that's not really how it works in the United States. I mean, there's a lot that you can say about why Hillary Clinton decided not to campaign in, you know, Michigan, why she didn't decide to campaign, you know, harder in other states where
she didn't go to Wisconsin once.
Yeah, right. I mean, that is their fault for sure. But still, I mean, if there was if everybody's vote counted the same in the United States, which is not the case, then she would have won. But we have a different system here.
Kevin, it's a full out witch hunt. Anyway, we want to keep talking to you and others about this. This is going to be a story that sadly is not going to go away. It's designed to poison relations between the United States and Russia to create hatred and animus. It's obviously, if anybody thinks for a moment that Russia was the reason Donald Trump is president, that would just be a garbage conclusion. But, you know, that's the thing about witch hunts. They have their own life, their own momentum. Everybody wants to be part of it. It's so much so that even when somebody becomes a critic of Donald Trump, like George W. Bush, the Democrats now love George W. Bush. Who would have thought? That was Kevin Zeis. He is the co-director of Popular Resistance. You can read his writings. I really encourage you to go to the website, popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.